In this segment, we will continue our discussion of interventions. We will begin by continuing our discussion of some critical appraisals of questions about clinical interventions. In particular, we will discuss the issue of hormone replacement therapy, which in many ways provides a classic lesson for evidence-based medicine, as I mentioned in the previous segment, almost a poster child for EBM. In the 1990s, there were a number of non-randomized controlled trial studies that suggested women who used hormone replacement therapy at any time had a lower mortality overall and from heart disease. Now, everyone knew that these non-controlled studies could always have the possibility of the difference being due to differences between those who used hormone replacement therapy and those who did not. And in fact, there had been some small randomized controlled trials that did yield conflicting results with some of the observational studies. So that led to the development of the Women's Health Initiative, which was begun in the mid-1990s and aimed to be the randomized controlled trial that settled the issue about hormone replacement therapy. Many believe this trial would show unequivocally that hormone replacement therapy was beneficial for postmenopausal women. Well, many of you are familiar with the outcomes of this trial and all the publications that have come out from it since then. But in essence, this study randomized over 16,000 women to hormone replacement therapy and placebo and was terminated early when there was a statistically significant increased risk of breast cancer from the hormone replacement therapy. There was also, to everyone's surprise, a statistically significant adverse effect in cardiovascular disease with a hazard ratio of 1.22. The deaths were relatively small, so the hazard ratio for cardiovascular and breast cancer deaths is not statistically significant. However, the study did show a protective benefit against colorectal cancer as well as fractures for women on hormone replacement therapy. So why did this study differ from the previous observational studies? Well, remember that anytime you have a non-controlled study, there's a risk that the intervention groups are not similar. And the previous observational studies looking at hormone replacement therapy basically compared women who chose to take hormone replacement therapy with those who did not. And there were likely differences between these groups. In fact, Linda Humphrey, a faculty member at OHSU, actually went back and looked at a number of the observational studies and found that if you actually controlled for socioeconomic status, the benefit of hormone replacement therapy in many of those studies would go away. So that is, women of higher socioeconomic status were healthier despite their desire to use hormone replacement therapy. In my view, another aspect of the Women's Health Initiative was that EBM actually worked. That is, we did a randomized controlled trial that controlled for the previous biases and uncontrolled studies, and we came up with a definitive answer. Another aspect that worked was that science adjusts to the facts, and there was ready admission that the less rigorous evidence, the observational studies, had led to incorrect conclusions. The Women's Health Initiative was actually a series of clinical trials, and some additional results were reported later. There was actually an estrogen-only arm, unlike the previous slides that looked at estrogen plus progesterone. And the estrogen-only arm also showed increased risk of stroke and deep venous thrombosis with no heart disease protection, but still some benefit for fracture. Further analysis of the combined therapy arm of the study showed that these women had increased risk of cardiovascular disease, an adverse effect on cognition over time, an increased risk of dementia and mild cognitive impairment, and increased risk of deep venous thrombosis. In other words, the overall outcome for those who were randomized to any type of hormone replacement therapy was negative, with the exception of some protection against colorectal cancer and fracture. However, there is some silver lining for hormone replacement therapy, although not much. But a subgroup analysis of women age 50 to 59 who had hysterectomy, so these were women who started hormone replacement therapy much closer to menopause as to some of the women who started it in their 60s and beyond. So those women who took estrogen only as compared to either the placebo group or the estrogen plus progesterone group had less coronary heart disease than the other groups, although the difference was not statistically significant, and less coronary artery calcification. One fortunate outcome was that for all women who took any type of hormone replacement therapy, coronary heart disease risk reverted to baseline within 3 years after stopping treatment, although the cancer risk did not. So another clinical intervention we'll look at is the tight control of diabetes to prevent its complications, which, as you may know, include kidney disease, eye disease, heart disease, and other things. The hypothesis is that if we control diabetes tighter, that is, if we use insulin to make the blood sugar follow the pattern physiologically of a person without diabetes, that we would prevent these complications. So there was a large study done looking at veterans in numerous VA hospitals who had long-standing type 2 diabetes. So that's what it used to be called, adult onset diabetes. And in this type of diabetes, there's usually an association with obesity, and there actually is plenty of circulating insulin in the blood, but it doesn't work as well. So the primary outcome looked at this study was time to occurrence of a cardiovascular event, which could have been any cardiovascular disease, such as myocardial infarction, angina pectoris, congestive heart failure, or other things. So the experimental group that had the tighter control of diabetes, and this was as measured by having a lower glycated hemoglobin level, so hemoglobin A1C level, so showing that their sugar was lower, there was no difference in primary outcome between those who had the lower glycated hemoglobin and those who were just treated in the usual care manner by primary care physicians. Not only that, but those in the intensive control group had intensive control of diabetes, that is, group, had a higher rate of adverse events, and most commonly they had episodes of hypoglycemia, of the blood sugar getting too low. This is an important study because one of the most common healthcare quality measures is a maintenance of the glycated hemoglobin under 7, yet this study shows that there may not be any benefit to doing that. Another study looked at control of diabetes in critically ill patients in intensive care units, looking at intensive control, so aiming to get the blood sugar down between 81 and 108 versus just trying to get it under 180. And those who had the more intensive control had higher mortality and also more complications, including hypoglycemia. So these studies have really raised some questions about how tightly we should aim to control diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes. Another form of intervention, of clinical intervention, is screening, where we screen for disease. We'll talk some about screening in the segment on diagnosis, but if you think about it, screening is an intervention. It's something we do to try to detect disease so we can either prevent it or treat it early. So the act of screening itself is an intervention, and as such, it's best assessed with a randomized controlled trial. So the general principle behind screening is that we should only screen for diseases that we have effective treatments for, i.e. the benefit of the treatment of that disease is shown in a randomized controlled trial. There's no sense in screening if we can't treat or do something for the patients that we detect the disease in early. So again, the goal of the screening intervention is to improve outcomes from the screening process. Well, probably one of the most controversial screening areas is whether men should be screened for prostate cancer with the prostate-specific antigen or PSA blood test. There are some attributes of prostate cancer that make screening difficult. One is that over time, as men get older, many of them tend to develop prostate cancer. In fact, it is known that as many as 50% of all men will harbor foci of prostate cancer in their prostate if they live into their 80s. And as they get older, the prostate cancer that develops is much less aggressive. There is an old adage that many men, especially elderly men, die with prostate cancer rather than of prostate cancer. However, there's been a big push over the last couple decades to screen for prostate cancer with the PSA test. And this has certainly led to more diagnosis of prostate cancer. But it's not clear that there's actually been benefit in terms of reducing mortality from prostate cancer. So should we do PSA screening for prostate cancer? Well, there have been some recent studies, but before we get into those, let's look at the larger picture about prostate cancer. So, prostate cancer treatment can reduce symptoms from the complications of the disease. So, things like urinary obstruction and reduction of pain from metastases to the bone. But prostate cancer treatment also has significant adverse effects, such as a quarter of all men developing impotence and 2-3% of men developing incontinence. Until 2005, there were actually no studies that showed any benefit in terms of long-term outcomes, such as reducing mortality from prostate cancer. However, a study published by Bill Axelson in 2005 did show that surgery in the form of radical prostatectomy provided some moderate benefits over what some describe as watchful waiting, is to basically just treat the symptoms of prostate cancer. In this study, which had a median follow-up of 8.2 years, the mortality rate of men assigned to surgery was somewhat lower than those assigned to watchful waiting. However, all of the difference was in men who were under 65, so there was no benefit to treatment for men over 65 who, remember in the last slide, I mentioned that the disease gets less aggressive when it develops in older men. And there was not, at least in this study, any benefit related to PSA screening or Gleason score, which is a measure of the virulence of prostate cancer. So, until recently, there was no evidence either for or against the PSA screening intervention, but there were some new studies published in early 2009 that helped, although still did not completely resolve the question. So there were finally two randomized controlled trials published in the same issue of the New England Journal of Medicine in early 2009 that assessed the intervention of PSA screening. One was the PLCO trial in the United States, looking at more than 76,000 men who were randomized to screening or usual care. This study found that there was a statistically significant higher rate of cancer diagnosis in the men who were screened, but no difference in the mortality. So in the screening group, about 85% of people were screened compared to about 40 to 52% per year in the control group. However, again, even though more cancer was diagnosed, there was no difference in mortality between the two groups. Another study was the European randomized study, which was actually a group of seven clinical trials in seven different countries, but the subjects were randomized to being offered screening or not being offered screening. Similar to the PLCO trial, there was a higher rate of cancer diagnosis. This one also showed a mildly beneficial effect in decreased mortality for screening. However, because the absolute risk reduction was so small, the result is that many men would need to be screened to prevent one death. The calculated absolute risk reduction was 0.71 deaths per 1,000 men, meaning that over 1,400 men would need to be screened to prevent one death. So again, there is some benefit, but it's small, and we would have to subject a lot of men to screening, which of course includes subsequent biopsies and other kinds of things, to prevent that one death. There's a very interesting perspective on the New England Journal of Medicine website, both as a video and the transcript of it, that provide a conversation between a urologist who treats prostate cancer and sees people die from it versus a health services researcher who looks at the cost effectiveness and balancing the benefits and the harms. So the PSA screening question has been somewhat answered in the fact that there might be some mild benefit, but there's certainly a lot of potential harm to go along with that benefit. So I've told you a lot about the importance of randomized controlled trials and answering questions about interventions, but there are some limitations of randomized controlled trials, sometimes more related to the people carrying them out rather than the idea of a trial itself. Sometimes we have incomplete evidence. Sometimes we don't need evidence. For example, do you need a randomized controlled trial of parachutes to keep you from jumping out of an airplane? So do parachutes prevent death and injury? Well, there aren't any controlled trials, but I think if you jumped out of an airplane, you would probably want a parachute. Another more serious issue with randomized controlled trials is that adverse events are not always well documented. One study looked at chemotherapy trials and found that there was not a good comprehensive spectrum of adverse effects that were documented in those trials. There's also the notion of publication bias, in that researchers who have positive results, who show something's beneficial, are more likely to publish their results. They're more likely to publish their results more quickly, so to try to get them into press quickly, and they're also more likely to be published in English language journals, which have a much wider dissemination than medical journals in other languages. Another limitation of randomized controlled trials, really more a human failing, is fraud. There are numerous cases of scientific fraud over the years. Every time you think that you've seen the last case of it, something new comes along. So just recently, for example, there were studies performed by an anesthesiology researcher, Rubin, that were found where he was found to have fabricated data in at least 21 randomized controlled trials on pain control. This revelation has really shook up the anesthesiology community because it's uncertain whether anything can be believed about any of these trials that were performed by Rubin. Likewise, another researcher, a prominent Harvard child psychiatrist, was captured promising results to a pharmaceutical company with the implication that just fund me to do your trial and I'll get you the results you want. one of the challenges is when these fraudulent studies come to light, it's not a simple matter to cleanse the literature. While it's a little bit easier with electronic publishing, you can post that a study has been retracted, but copies of this study have been made. Of course, there's all the paper copies that were mailed out to people who have subscriptions to paper journals. These studies get cited by other studies, and it's a real challenge to try to cleanse the literature, as Harold Sox, the editor of Annals of Internal Medicine, found when some fraudulent studies were found to have been published in that journal. There are other limitations of randomized controlled trials. Sometimes they're difficult to do. It's difficult to blind the patient, the clinician. It's clearly easiest to do randomized controlled trials with drugs. You give someone the drug or the placebo. But it's harder with other interventions, although it's not impossible. So, for example, complementary and alternative medicine systems, it may be best to do what are sometimes called whole practice studies, where you don't just study the single acupuncture needling or the Chinese herbal preparation, but you study the whole practice of, say, traditional Chinese medicine compared to a conventional approach. Sometimes technologies change. This is particularly true in areas like telemedicine, where telecommunication networks improve, and the study may start and the technology is improving and you have to account for that. So people call these tracker trials, where you focus on the best current technologies even if those technologies change over the course of the trial. And then you have the issue of expertise. Should you do a clinical trial for, say, some surgical procedure where considerable skill is required? And so it's been advocated that we only carry out expertise-based surgical trials where we control for the expertise of the clinician who's performing the procedure. There are also calls for more practical clinical trials, that sometimes clinical trials answer research questions that are more interesting to the researcher rather than the clinicians who are going to be using the results. So Tunis has called for practical clinical trials that compare clinically relevant questions and outcomes from a variety of heterogeneous yet realistic practice settings. Another problem of randomized controlled trials is selective reporting, when the researchers do not report all of the data. This is a form of publication bias, although it's a much more pernicious form because it may be done for economic gain. It's well known that pharmaceutical companies don't outright lie in advertising, but will manipulate facts and figures to make the drug look as good as possible. There have been a few instances where they have suppressed results, where there is some clause in the contract with the researcher doing the clinical trial, and the pharmaceutical company doesn't allow the researcher to suppress the results. This came to light with a study that was done on generic forms of thyroid hormone. Another interesting phenomenon is the materials, the studies that get submitted to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to obtain approval of a drug. Pharmaceutical companies are required to submit every trial that's been done, every bit of experimental data, yet some of that data does not end up in articles and journals, so the journal picture of a paper may be considerably different than the larger volume of data that's submitted to the FDA. This was found to be particularly problematic with antidepressants, where Eric Turner, an OHSU faculty member, was able to obtain data from 74 studies that had been registered with the FDA assessing antidepressants. Of the 38 studies that have a positive result, 37 were published. Of the 36 negative studies, so studies that the antidepressant was not more effective than the placebo, 22 were not published. 11 were altered in a way so that they conveyed a positive outcome, and 3 were published. So there's growing concerns that drug companies are not giving the whole picture with regards to their drugs, although, as we'll see in a moment, this is starting to change with things like clinical trials registration. So what do we make of all this? I've taken you on a whirlwind tour of a topic you can probably tell is of great interest to me, which is randomized controlled trials. So we know that even science and evidence-based medicine are fallible to human shortcomings. But remember, at least in my opinion, the solution is better science, not saying that we shouldn't do randomized controlled trials because they can be subverted. So in the case of randomized controlled trials, we need reporting of both absolute and relative risk reductions so we can look at both the relative benefit and the overall larger absolute benefit. There needs to be registration of trials and clear adherence to study protocols and clear disclosure of conflict of interest.